Hi, this is the January 2024 edition of Junior Scholastic Magazine. I'm Chris Radio Volunteer, Kathy Danaher. The headline on the front page of the January issue is, Start It Up. Why are so many teens launching their own businesses? And on the cover, we see a photo of three teens. Each one is holding up the product that they were inspired to create and turn into a self-run business. Let's turn the page, and we begin first with geography. Guardians of Easter Island. Hundreds of giant statues stand watch over a tiny island in the Pacific. Can a new discovery help unravel the mysteries surrounding them? On pages 2 and 3 are photos of these giant stone statues. They're called Mo'ai. All are made of rock from ancient volcanoes. And on the upper right is a picture of a lake that dried up in recent years, revealing some of the newly discovered statues that had been buried. You're looking at possibly the most remote place where people live on Earth, Easter Island. The tiny island sits about 2,200 miles off the coast of Chile. It is home to about 8,000 people. Those who are native to the island call themselves and their home Rapa Nui. But the island's most famous residents are the famous Mo'ai, stone figures with unreadable expressions. There are about 1,000 of them scattered around the island. Historians aren't sure why they were made or exactly how they were moved around the hilly terrain. Experts estimate that many of the Mo'ai were carved hundreds of years ago, between 1100 and 1600. The largest is 33 feet tall and weighs 80 tons. Some of the most photographed Mo'ai are buried in the sand, with just their shoulders and heads sticking out, like they were planted, as one French explorer wrote in the 1800s. The Rapa Nui believed that the sculptures represent ancient chiefs who were related to gods. Researchers recently got a new clue that may help shed light on the mysteries of the statues. In February 2023, they uncovered another Mo'ai on the island. The figure is in a dried-up lake bed. The statue is the first found in that spot. The Rapa Nui hoped the location will yield more statues, and possibly even the tools used to carve them. This discovery is something historic for this new generation, said a spokesperson for the Rapa Nui after the find. The statues are so well known that there's even a Mo'ai emoji. Next, U.S. and world news. Cool school alert. What if your homework was to play video games? And the picture on the top of the page shows teens in a classroom playing in a video tournament. Watara Yoshudi's school looks like a spaceship. It has sleek glass floors and glowing neon tubes on the ceiling, and it's shaped like a pod. But the decor isn't the only unusual part. The 16-year-old's daily classwork includes hours of video game training. The teen and about 24 others attend Japan's first Esports High School, which opened in Tokyo in 2022. Esports is short for electronic sports. Players play off and organize video game competitions, typically in teams. Over the past 20 years, esports have soared in popularity around the world. They have become a billion-dollar industry. Wataru's school was founded to train future professional gamers, but educators say the academy is also addressing a major challenge, getting struggling students back in school. School absenteeism, which is often linked to anxiety or bullying, has long been a problem in Japan. The country's schools have strict rules, which can be difficult for many students. Some refuse to attend at all. Wataru, for example, often stayed home and played video games instead. That's where the Esports school stands out. 3 days a week, pros teach students strategies for games like Fortnite. The other two, students take subjects like math and science. Classes don't start until 10 a.m., and no uniforms are required. Wataru, who is thriving there, hopes to make it big as a gamer. "I should probably go home," he said, after a recent video game tournament at school. Instead, he returned to his monitor. It was time to go back to his team. Continuing on page 5 under Technology, the article reads, "That's Dr. Drone to you." Is your family sick with the flu? Don't fret. If you live in College Station, Texas, or Lockford, California, flying robots could be coming to the rescue. Amazon is testing a program in those areas that use drones to deliver prescription medicines. The initiative is part of a growing trend. More companies are turning to drone deliveries to meet customer demands for speed and convenience. Here's how Amazon's program works. After a customer places an order, a worker puts the medicine, safe in a padded package, into the drone. Then the robot zips off. When it nears your home, it can detect if people or pets are in the way. If the coast is clear, it drops the delivery. And in the upper right corner of the page, we see a picture of the kind of drone that is currently being used to safely make medicine deliveries. If this pilot program goes well, Amazon plans to expand the service to other places in the U.S. and Europe. Now that's just what the doctor ordered. On the bottom of page 5, under Pop Culture, the article is "Playing for Keeps." That Nerf ball isn't just for playing anymore. It's officially part of history. Nerf toys, Cabbage Patch Kids, and baseball cards were recently inducted into the National Toy Hall of Fame in Rochester, New York. A panel of historians and other experts chose them based on design, popularity, and how long they've been around, and how much creativity they spark. To the right of the article, we see photos of the baseball cards, Cabbage Patch Kids doll, and a Nerf ball. The slogan that really sold the soft, spongy Nerf ball was, "Throw it indoors, you can't damage lamps or break windows." On page 6, the title of the article is "Teens in Charge." More and more young people are starting their own companies. Meet 5 teens who turned their bright ideas into big profits. But first, here are some business words to know that you're going to hear used in the article. Asset, something that is useful or considered valuable. Chief Executive Officer, the highest ranking manager or the leader of a business or other organization. Entrepreneur, a person who starts a new business. Liability, a loan or other debt that a person or business is legally required to pay. Manufacturer, a person or company that makes goods. And finally, revenue, income, money that a business, an organization, or a government earns or is paid. Youngman Kane is building an empire out of slime. It started 7 years ago when she was 13 and saw a video of homemade slime on Instagram. She noticed that the goo was all the rage with her friends at school, too. So Youngman began making her own slime out of glue and borax in her home in Round Rock, Texas. Borax is a powdery household cleaner. With $200 from her dad, she launched a company called Snoop Slimes in 2017. That year, Youngman sold her first slime products on Etsy, an online shopping site, for between $8 and $10 each. She also posted videos of her creations on social media. Within a year, she had more than 1 million Instagram followers and was getting about 100 orders a week. Fast forward to today, and Youngman, 20, is the chief executive officer, CEO, of a million-dollar company with 40 employees. Slime products on Snoop Slime's website, such as Rubber Ducky Bubble Bath and Gumball Explosion, now sell for $15 and up. "A lot of people told me to wait until I'm older," Youngman says, "but being young really allowed me to step out of my comfort zone and just get started without being afraid." Her success at such a young age might sound unusual, but she's actually one of many teen entrepreneurs around the country who have started their own businesses. In fact, some of the biggest companies today, including Meta, which owns Facebook and Instagram, Subway, and UPS, were started by teens. On the left side of page 6, we see a picture of young Min Kang smiling and standing next to a green slime cake she designed and decorated to look like an edible treat. 3 out of 5 American teens say they would rather start their own business than have a traditional job. That's according to a survey by Citizens Financial Group and Junior Achievement USA, which teaches young people financial skills. Why the focus on entrepreneurship? Experts like Ed Grachilski from Junior Achievement say social media and business reality TV shows like Shark Tank have captured the attention of young people. It just makes entrepreneurship appear much more accessible than maybe it was thought of in the past, he says. For many teen entrepreneurs, inspiration starts with an idea. Basically, the definition of entrepreneurship is finding a solution to a problem, says Grachowski. He suggests that building young entrepreneurs look for a need within their community and then fill that gap, whether it's babysitting, lawn care, or something else. For Ava Dorsey, 16, the problem she wanted to solve was a lack of quality pet treats. The teen from Westmont, Illinois, has loved dogs and cats for as long as she can remember. She noticed that many store-bought treats contained unhealthy ingredients. I knew I wanted to help pets live the happiest, longest lives possible, she says. So, in 2015, when Ava was 8 years old, she started an all-natural pet treat company called Ava's Pet Palace, working in her family's kitchen. There, she experimented with ingredients like bananas and peanut butter. Then Ava started selling her treats at craft shows. As her business grew, local pet stores began selling her products. Today, Ava's Pet Palace dog and cat treats are available online and in stores across the country. Ava gets a lot of help from her mother, the company's only full-time employee. She also hired a manufacturer to produce the pet treats, and she still experiments with new recipes. As her business grows, Ava makes it a point to help animals in need. Each month, she donates a portion of her company's profits to animal charities and rescue organizations. Helping others is a goal Ava believes much of her generation shares, especially teen entrepreneurs. We do what we can do to try make the world a better place, she says. On the bottom of page 8, we see a picture of Ava with her dog Lacey, and the caption reads, Ava Dorsey uses healthy ingredients in her line of dog and cat treats. Giving back is something Sebastian Martinez, 16, and his brother Brandon, 18, seeks to do too. In 2014, they launched Are You Kidding? With their mother's help. The company sells unique sock designs, and the brothers donate 20% of their revenue to charity. Since making their first sale of the shoe shop near their home in Miami, Florida, they've sold about 500,000 pairs of socks at fairs and online. Through charity events and partnerships, they've also raised more than $400,000 for pediatric cancer treatments and other causes. Sebastian is the CEO, and Brandon is the director of sales. Because of their age, however, they say it took time to convince partners and manufacturers to take them seriously. But when they saw how dedicated we were, Brandon says, we earned their respect. When it comes to running a business, experts say that teens may have a big leg up. They already know their way around Instagram and TikTok and are tapped into what's trending. But a lot more goes into being an entrepreneur than what you see on social media. There are requirements to follow, such as applying for a business license and paying taxes. And there are laws governing what teens can and cannot do. For example, Many business owners form a limited liability company, or LLC. This protects their personal assets, such as homes and cars, if someone files a lawsuit against their business. But some states don't allow teens to have LLCs. Young people also can't open bank accounts by themselves or apply for business loans. And most contracts signed by minors don't have the same legal status as contracts signed by adults. That can affect young people's ability to hire employees and partner with manufacturers. For these reasons, experts recommend that budding young business owners research the laws where they live, and when necessary, reach out to an adult for help. A good start, they say, can be to meet with the official in charge of business licenses in their town. Teen entrepreneurs have the added difficulty of managing a business and keeping up with schoolwork at the same time. "That's definitely been the most challenging part," says Young Min, the CEO of Snoop Slimes. "I had to figure out my time management skills." A typical work week for Young Min consists of testing new slime recipes and meeting with employees. She also develops business strategies to help promote her products. For example, Snoop Slimes drops limited release slimes on its website every Friday evening. Young Min is now a freshman in college, but she took a year off after graduating from high school in 2022 to focus on her business. She also hired her mom in 2019 as a full-time manager to help run the company. Despite all the work, though, many teen entrepreneurs say being their own boss is worth it. Keith Griffin III, 16, is one of them. He is the founder of Being Together. He raises bees and sells honey products in his hometown of Louisville, Kentucky. He also partners with other local beekeepers to help sell their honey and raises awareness about mental health issues. Keith started Being Together in 2019 to help him take his mind off the difficulty of having parents who were in prison at the time. He made his first sales by going door to door around his neighborhood. Now his products are sold in stores and restaurants near his hometown and on his website. Keith hopes to keep expanding his company. His advice for other teens who want to start a business is simple. Just go for it. You can create and do whatever you want. On the bottom of page 9, we see a picture of Keith inspecting part of his beekeeping equipment. And on the upper right of the page are 4 suggestions on how to start a business. 1 is brainstorming ideas. Come up with an idea for your business. 2, research your competitors. Determine what sets your business idea apart from companies that already exist. 3, make a business plan. Set goals for your company by drafting a business plan. And 4, secure funding. Calculate how much money you'll need to start your business and then determine how you will seek funding. On page 10, what should be done about over-tourism? On the top of the page is a photo of the Parthenon, a part of the Acropolis on an ancient fortress in Greece, with crowds of tourists packed in to see this popular site. In Athens, Greece, crowds pack in elbow to elbow to explore the ancient ruins of the Acropolis. In Paris, France, tens of thousands of people line up to glimpse at the Mona Lisa, the world's most famous painting. In Rome, Italy, masses of tourists jostle for selfies near the centuries-old Trevi Fountain. And that's just in one day. From 2021 to 2022, the number of visitors to Europe doubled. Nearly 90 million arrived in July 2023 alone, according to the World Tourism Organization. As a result, many treasured sites are suffering from over-tourism. Over-tourism happens when too many people flock to a particular place, causing damage. Historical sites are especially at risk. Fragile ruins can wear away when too many people walk on them day after day, for example. Landmarks are also hurt by pollution, trash, and traffic that tourists bring with them. A lot of these places were not designed to handle the amount of people that they now see, says Danielle Wilkins, an architectural historian in Atlanta, Georgia. She studies how historical locations around the world are affected by tourists. Still, while over-tourism causes problems, tourism itself is good for cities and towns. Visitors stay in local hotels, eat at local restaurants, and shop at local stores. The money they spend helps local economies. So what should be done to protect these sites without banning tourists entirely? Here are three approaches officials are taking. Decide which you think is best and why. Fix number one, limit visitors. In September, the Acropolis began capping visitors at 20,000 a day, with timed slots to even out crowds. Previously, up to 23,000 a day had been coming, with many arriving at the same time, in the morning, hoping to be first in line. Other attractions are also using timed entries and visitor limits to manage overcrowding. The Louvre Museum in Paris, site of the Mona Lisa, now limits visitors to 30,000 a day. That's 15,000 fewer than were coming in on its busiest days. Louvre officials say the change gives guests a more enjoyable experience and reduces wait times. But such limits can be frustrating for tourists, especially if they aren't able to see the attractions they crossed an ocean to visit. Fix number two, charge extra fees. Some local governments hope that charging additional fees or taxes will result in fewer tourists. Venice, Italy, is betting on that plan. Its beautiful canals draw about 30 million visitors each year. Starting this spring, city officials will charge daytime visitors ages 14 and up a fee to enter Venice on its busiest days. In Spain, the city of Santiago de Compostela is adding a tourist tax for hotel guests starting next year. The popular destination, it's known for its ornate cathedral and has seen tourism soar over the past 2 years. But some people say the fees have gone too far. After all, airfare and hotels are already pricey. If we're adding another cost, then are we saying only people with a lot of money can experience these places? Wilkins asks. Fix number three, educate tourists. Planning to visit the Eiffel Tower in Paris? Why not consider the Chantilly Castle outside the city instead? France is using ads to push visitors towards lesser-known sites within its borders instead of to its heavily visited attractions. One city in Croatia is promoting better behavior among tourists. Dubrovnik recently kicked off a campaign called Respect the City. Visitors arriving on planes and cruise ships are shown a video reminding them not to litter or use bikes or electric scooters in the city's historical center. Still, some people wonder if these campaigns really make a difference. Others caution that steering visitors to smaller sites could push over tourism to locations that are even less equipped to handle big crowds. On page 12, under World News, the next article is called A Shot at an Education. Michigan State basketball player Made Sissoko left Mali as a teen. Now he's using his success to bring education to his home village. A truck rumbled over bumpy dirt roads in the West African country of Mali this past spring. Sitting in the back seat, Made Sissoko watched the familiar scenery of his home country roll by. He had left his village of Tangafoya as a 15-year-old to play basketball in the United States. Now, 7 years later, he was a star center on Michigan State University's top-ranked team. He was returning to Tangafoya to celebrate an even more important accomplishment, the opening of the first-ever school in his village. It was all thanks to Sissoko, now 23, and a college senior. He started the foundation that funded the school in Tangafoya, and he was about to see the school for the first time. As the truck rounded the final corner to the village, children dashed out to greet Sissoko with a hero's welcome. Hundreds of people gathered around, thanking him. The 6-foot-9-inch athlete almost cried tears of joy, seeing how many lives he had touched. "People there, they don't have the opportunities," he says of Tangafoya. "I got an opportunity. Ever since I came to the United States, I wanted to give that back." In Mali, many children are not able to attend school. The one reason is that the nearest classroom is often hours away. Sissoko knows that firsthand. Plenty of his childhood friends did not go to school simply because Tangafoya didn't have one. But though Sissoko's parents never had the chance to get an education themselves, they were determined that their son should get one. And so, every morning, Sissoko left his home by 6:30 a.m. to walk 90 minutes to class. Sometimes the temperature would top 100 degrees Fahrenheit. He would not get home from school until nearly 6 p.m. Thinking about the future helped him stay motivated, even on hard mornings. Sissoko said, "You wake up in the morning and you can just think, nah, I'm not going to go to school today." He recalls, "You definitely have to have a vision that no matter what, I'm going to do this." When not in school, Sissoko, the youngest of 10 children, had to weed and plow his family's cornfields. Tangafoya is a farming village whose 900 residents grow all the food they eat: corn, beans, peanuts, rice, and millet. Sissoko, too, expected to become a farmer. One day in 2015, Sissoko got a huge surprise. His older brothers, Soleimane, a soldier in Mali's military, had met two Americans who were volunteering in Mali. Soleimane told the men about Sissoko's height and basketball skills. They agreed to meet him. Sissoko had only recently picked up a basketball for the first time. He knew little about the rules and had never played in an organized game, but he could dunk. The American men, Paul Olson and Michael Clayton, were impressed with what they saw. With his family's approval, they began the process of bringing Sissoko to the United States to play high school basketball. "We said, well, let's give this kid an opportunity," says Clayton, who became one of Sissoko's guardians. By 2016, Sissoko was headed to Utah for high school. There, he lived with a host family. It was a hard transition. Sissoko felt homesick and wondered if he'd make the right choice. He spoke Bambara, the local language of Mali, and French, but no one around him understood those languages. He often had to act things out in order to communicate. Sissoko's basketball skills became good enough for him to be recruited by Michigan State University, MSU, in 2019. But he failed the language test given to all non-English-speaking students. In order to enroll at MSU, he had to take weeks of English classes. He spent up to 6 hours a day tackling the coursework, and he succeeded. Sissoko has since maintained good grades. After taking the court for the MSU Spartans in 2020, Sissoko announced a new goal. He wanted to share his good fortune with his home village. But how? The answer soon appeared. In July 2021, the National Collegiate Athletic Association began letting college athletes profit from the use of their name, image, or likeness. Though the rules don't permit international students to make money that way, they are allowed to start foundations and seek charitable contributions. That's what Sissoko did. He created the Madi Sissoko Foundation to open a school in Tangafoya. He set a goal of raising $50,000 and exceeded it by quite a lot, he says. He was also able to fund a well, providing fresh drinking water for the village for the first time, and an irrigation system to help the farmers water their crops. In September 2023, classes began at the one-story school. The four classrooms, filled with long wooden tables and chairs, can hold up to 70 students each. The school is the only structure with electricity in the village, And of course, it has a basketball hoop. On page 13, we see a picture of Mahdi helping a young student shoot a basket outside the school he built in Mali. Sissoko isn't done yet, though. He also hopes to someday build a hospital in Tangafora. And Sissoko toured the school for the first time, children tugging him into the classrooms. Adults talked to him about the new well. Everyone was thrilled to see what Sissoko had done. Even more, they were grateful for what he had done. And in the upper right of page 15, we see a picture of students who attend a private school in Bamako, Mali's capital. On page 16, the road to the White House. The presidential election is less than a year away, and candidates are racing along the campaign trail. What can you expect during the busy election season? Here's your step-by-step guide to the process. First, primaries and caucuses. Starting January 15th, voters in every state and U.S. territory, as well as the District of Columbia, pick their favorite candidate in a primary or a caucus, a political party meeting. These contests determine which Democratic and Republican candidates will become their party's official nominee. Second, Super Tuesday and beyond. March 5th is Super Tuesday, the day when the greatest number of states hold primaries and caucuses. Super Tuesday is often a turning point. By the time the votes are counted, one or two candidates for each party likely have a clearer lead, causing many other candidates to drop out of the race. Third, the conventions. Delegates from each state attend their party's national convention. Based on their state's primary or caucus results, they nominate a candidate and that person's choice for vice president. This year, the Republican convention is July 15th through 18th in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and the Democratic convention is August 19th through 22nd in Chicago, Illinois. The fourth, the debates. The official nominees for president share the stage at televised debates, giving voters a chance to see how they respond to challenging questions about key issues. The vice presidential candidates also have at least one debate. The party nominees continue to crisscross the nation, making speeches, giving interviews to reporters, and appearing in election ads to connect with voters. The fifth step, Election Day. Some states allow early voting in person or by mail, but Tuesday, November 5th, Election Day, is the last chance to cast a ballot. Candidates for the House of Representatives, some Senate seats, and some state and local offices are on the ballot, too. But voters don't directly elect a president. They are choosing electors, special delegates who pledge to vote for a particular candidate. Each state's number of electors is based on its population. Number 6, the Electoral College vote. On Tuesday, December 17th, the electors chosen in the November election gather in each state. Together they make up the Electoral College. They cast the official votes for president and vice president. There are 538 electors. A candidate needs votes from at least 270 electors to win. After that, number 7, Congress declares the winner. On January 6th of every year following a presidential election, members of the U.S. Congress gather to count the electoral votes. The incumbent, the person currently in office, vice president, oversees the count and announces the official winner. Usually, this process is just a formality. However, if no candidate has won at least 270 electoral votes, House members choose a president, and senators pick the vice president. That has happened only twice, in 1800 and 1824. And finally, number 8, Inauguration Day. A new four-year presidential term begins on January 20th. At the inauguration, the winning candidate takes the oath of office, vowing to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. That evening, the president celebrates at the inaugural ball before diving into the job of running the country. On page 18, a 5-minute guide to primaries and caucuses. Who picks the official Democratic and Republican nominees for president? Voters in every state, through primaries and caucuses. The Democratic nominee is most likely to be President Joe Biden, who is running for re-election with little opposition. When this issue went to press, 8 Republicans were competing to be their party's nominee. Here's a look at the contest that will determine the victor. What's the difference? Primary and caucus? In a primary, voters cast secret ballots by mail or at the polls on their state's primary election day. In a caucus, voters gather in a school, church, or other public place to discuss their party's candidates. Then they vote. Who can vote? Voters in national elections must be 18 or older and U.S. citizens. In most states, people can vote in a party's contest only if they have registered in advance as a member of that party. Some states let independent voters choose one party's contest to vote in. There's a question here. Why aren't all the contests at once? It's a big country. Staggered dates let candidates campaign in a few states at a time. But there are pros and cons to this system. One of the pros is, as their state's date approaches, voters may get a chance to see candidates in person. A con to this system could be, candidates who lose an early contest tend to drop out. That can give votes in states with early dates more weights than ones that are cast later. The last article on page 19 under U.S. History is entitled, The Fire That Changed America. In 1911, a deadly blaze led to a new era of workers' rights and fire safety laws. This is the story of a teen who was there. It all happened so quickly. One minute, 16-year-old Ethel Monick was packing up to go home from her job at the Triangle Waste Company factory. The next, flames and hot choking smoke were everywhere. It was Saturday, March 25th, 1911, an ordinary spring day in New York City. The Triangle factory whirred with activity. Its 500 workers, mostly young immigrant women like Ethel, made shirtwaists, a popular style of woman's blouse. Triangle was located on the top 3 floors of a 10-story building. Ethel worked on the 9th floor, where most of the sewing was done. Workers sat at 8 long tables lined with sewing machines. Ethel's job was to rush unfinished garments from one sewer to another. At 4:45 p.m., the ending bell rang. Like the others, Ethel had labored about 52 hours through 6 days that week. She was looking forward to the next day, Sunday, her only day off. Then, Ethel caught sight of flames streaming through the windows lining one side of the room. I screamed, "Fire!" And almost as soon as I did that, the flames were all around on the inside, she would later say. Ethel was caught in the middle of one of the worst workplace disasters in U.S. history. More than half of the people on her floor would not survive. In all, 146 Triangle workers would die in the blaze. Yet out of this horror would come sweeping reforms in workers' rights and in fire safety rules. Those advances have saved countless lives in the generations since. On the top of page 20, we see a photograph of the burning building, and we see the New York City firefighters trying to put out the blaze from the street below. On the bottom of the page is a photo of what a shirtwaist blouse looked like. It was very popular with women in 1911, and also a picture of the Singer sewing machine that was salvaged from the Triangle factory. In the beginning of the 20th century, New York City was home to a booming garment industry. More than 40% of all clothing sold in the United States was made there. But the work was grueling for the men, women, and children who sewed those garments. Hundreds of thousands of them were recent immigrants. many piece together clothes in their own cramped homes. Even in large workplaces such as Triangle, people worked long hours for low pay. If workers were out sick or got injured, they often lost their jobs. Compared with many factories, Triangle was a big improvement. Located in a new high-rise building, its workspaces were bright and airy. It was considered a state-of-the-art building, says Triangle historian Michael Hirsch. However, like most high-rises in New York City at the time, it was not fire-safe. The stairs were narrow and twisting, making it impossible for large numbers of people to evacuate quickly. It had only one rickety fire escape, and there was no law requiring buildings to have sprinklers, even though experts knew they could save lives. What's more, few factories held fire drills because doing so would have interfered with production. That meant that when the fire broke out, people did not know how to escape. The trouble started on the 8th floor at about 4:40 p.m. Workers there cut big sheets of cotton into pieces and tossed the leftover material into bins. An employee likely threw a smoldering match or cigarette butt into one of those bins. In an instant, the fabric scraps ignited. Flames spread from bin to bin. Managers and workers rushed to put the fire out with buckets of water, but it was too intense. Flames began pouring out of the windows, racing toward the upper two floors of the factory. The phone operator on the 8th floor called to alert the 10th floor. That warning allowed the people there to escape up to the roof. But in the chaos, no one warned the 9th floor, where Ethel and her co-workers were finishing for the day. By the time they saw the fire, it had exploded into a raging inferno. Frantically, they tried to climb over the long tables from the flames. But where could they go? On the 9th floor, fire and smoke quickly blocked all but four paths to safety. One was the fire escape, but it was soon overcrowded with dozens of frantic workers and tore away from the building. Almost none of those people survived. Now there were just three ways out of the 9th floor, two passenger elevators and a staircase. With a crowd of workers pressing in around her, Ethel ran to the staircase door and tried to yank it open. The door wouldn't budge. It was locked. She was certain. The crowd pushed Ethel toward the elevators, the last route of escape. Heroically, Joseph Zito and Gaspar Montalillo, the building's elevator operators, kept making trips up through the flames, but only about two dozen workers could fit at a time, and Ethel could only watch as car after car left without her. Those who did manage to get into the elevators looked back to witness a terrible sight. Desperate to escape the fire, some of the workers were jumping out of the windows. Back at the elevators, Ethel was crushed between dozens of frantic workers. She thought for certain she was doomed. Then, miraculously, an empty elevator door opened in front of her. The rush of women pushed her in, smashing her against the elevator's back wall. After a ride down that felt like an eternity, Ethel found herself on the street. Overcome with emotion, she began scratching at her face and tearing her hair. "There were 150 girls up there who will never get out," she told a newspaper reporter. By now, a crowd had gathered, horrified at the scene unfolding above them. Firefighters had arrived quickly, but the fire pressure from the hydrants on the street was too weak to subdue the flames. They set up a ladder to rescue the workers gathered on the 9th floor ledge, but only reached the 6th floor. Firefighters battled the flames floor by floor. Within half an hour, they had contained the fire. But in that brief period, 146 workers had died. Dozens of them had jumped. New Yorkers were outraged. A week later, many of them held a meeting to protest conditions in the city's factories. Speakers from labor unions, groups organized to protect the rights of workers, argued that business owners cared more about making money than keeping their employees safe. "The life of men and women is so cheap," Rose Schneiderman of the International Ladies' Garment Workers Union proclaimed. About 2 weeks after the fire, 7 unidentified Triangle victims were buried in a single grave. More than 120,000 people marched in a funeral procession in the rain while hundreds of thousands looked on. Many people blamed the Triangle factory owners, Max Blank and Isaac Harris, for the catastrophe. They were certain the men had locked the 9th-floor staircase door to keep employees from stealing fabric. That December, Blank and Harris were tried on charges of manslaughter. Ethel and her workers testified against them, but the jury couldn't agree on whether the door had been locked, or if it had, whether the owners knew about it or not. The men were acquitted or released from their charges. Still, the Triangle fire led to profound change. Just 2 months after the disaster, New York State formed a commission to study the conditions in thousands of factories. That group's recommendations resulted in dozens of laws that greatly improved conditions for factory workers. Some of the most important new rules revolutionized fire safety. For the first time, automatic sprinklers were mandatory in most buildings. Companies are also required to show workers where and how to evacuate in case of an emergency. New York's reforms then spread to other states. Triangle is the reason we have fire drills, says Hirsch, so that you know how to save yourself and your friends. Outrage over the disaster also prompted the rise of labor unions like the ILGWU, which became powerful forces for workers' rights. In the end, many Americans responded to the tragedy by making important changes in how workers were treated, says Peter Leibold, a curator at the Smithsonian Institution. Triangle became an iconic event that transformed the country for the better. As for Ethel, surviving the Triangle fire remained a defining incident in her life. Nearly half a century later, a historian visited Ethel, who was surrounded by her grandchildren. The world of those young people was already so different. They went to school, not work, each morning, and they didn't have to worry about their safety as Ethel had. To them, her stories of the long-ago tragedy seemed almost impossible. "They have all listened to me politely," Ethel said to the historian about the Triangle fire. "But you know, I think not one of them has ever really believed me. Now, you please tell them." On page 21 is an insert called "A Changing Population." In the 19th century, millions of people left their homelands, fleeing hunger, poverty, or violence. They traveled to a new land with strange language and customs, the United States. Between 1880 and 1920, historians say about 18 million new immigrants entered the United States. Millions of them arrived by boat in New York City and stayed there. Many settled into a neighborhood called the Lower East Side. By one estimate, about 500,000 people lived in that area of roughly 1.5 square miles. Families squashed into tiny dark rooms in often run-down apartment buildings called tenements. Hundreds of thousands of those immigrants labored in New York's garment industry. And yet, the neighborhood buzzed with life. People speaking multiple languages mixed on the streets. Countless push carts lined the sidewalks, filled with eggs, cloth, chicken wings, candles, butter, you name it. "Every conceivable thing is for sale," said a 1901 state government report. The immigrants were changing the city and American life. That's it for this installment of Junior Scholastic. I'm Kathy Danaher, Chris Volunteer. So long, until next month.